morning and welcome to Mound Money on this fortunately snowy Monday morning. I'm Doug Wells. In studio with me is our frequent guest co-host, Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Doug, and it is indeed a pleasure to look out the window here at Sweet Alley and for the first time in a long time, see the white stuff coming down pretty heavily.
Hopefully it continues for a while. Renee Bodley is on assignment this morning, so you're with the two of us this morning. We've got a great show for you. Our first guest is Phil Dean. He's with the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. Phil is the State Budget Director. He's also the Chief Economist for the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget. And they recently did a forum where they talked about the Utah economic outlook and talked about the financial health of the state of Utah. We're going to get an update there, get the main thoughts that came out of that summit. And also hopefully outlook for, you know, what is 2018, what does 2019 look like for Utah?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to ask him about the events that have happened since last Tuesday, because there's certainly been a lot of interesting economic news that has come up and down since then.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
Okay.
And Roger, tell us about our second and third guests.
Our program continues with our second guest being Jean David of Outer Isle Gourmet. Outer Isle Gourmet produces a really interesting set of cauliflower pizza crusts and sandwich thins, which are now available here in Park City at the Whole Foods. And finally, we'll have Colleen McGuinn. Colleen is the owner of Megamind's Trivia, which sponsors trivia contests around town and has become an increasing presence. She now seems to be somewhere almost three or four nights a week.
Great. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369, Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays!
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo's been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mound Money. On the phone with us now is Phil Dean. He works at the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. He is the State Budget Director. He's also the Chief Economist for the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget. Phil, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning, Phil. I had an opening question for you, which is tell us a little bit about the organizations that you run and what is their basic function?
Yeah, so the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, obviously we work for the governor and work with him on fiscal matters. So as part of that, we produce the state's revenue estimates in conjunction with the Legislative Fiscal Analyst Office and the State Tax Commission. And we also work with the governor to prepare his budget recommendations that he makes to the legislature. And then after enactment of the budget, work with state agencies in carrying out their fiscal functions. So that includes not only kind of managing the budget, making sure things are handled correctly there, but also working with state agency operations and working to improve those.
So is it somewhat analogous to what OMB does at the federal level?
Yes, very similar to that.
Okay, and speaking of the federal level, the president a couple weeks ago did his State of the Union. I should know this, but I do not. The State of the State that Governor Herbert gives, did he give that recently, or is that still coming up?
Yes, he gave that a couple weeks ago, the first week of the legislative session.
Okay, great. And you guys did a summit here recently to talk about the financial health of Utah. Give us the overlook. What were the main takeaways?
Yeah, so it is kind of interesting looking at where we've come from over the last few years. It is interesting as we look back, coming from the trough of the Great Recession till now, we actually have the strongest job growth rate overall in the U.S., which is pretty remarkable to see what's taken place. You know, as far as going forward, we're projecting continued growth in the Utah economy. There's obviously question out there about what impact is what's happening at the federal level with federal tax reform and with spending expansions, it looks like, over the last week. some of that, you know, some of those decisions look like potentially been made. And then on the other side with monetary policy, what's happening with that? How quickly will interest rates rise, and how will that impact the economy? All that said, we're projecting continued growth, not only here in Utah, but nationally, especially with the tax cuts and some of the impacts that that will have in terms of putting more money in people's wallets.
Yeah, well, let's unwrap some of that. You're projecting continued growth. Our unemployment rate is one of the lowest in the country as well. How do we as a state continue to grow with our unemployment rate as low as it is?
Yeah, and I think that's not only short-term but long-term. One of our major challenges is having a skilled workforce, having enough people to fill the jobs. So part of that certainly is internal, with internal not only population growth, but then educating our own citizens here in the state, but then also attracting people from out of the state to come in. So that's, I think, one of the biggest constraints, again, not only for this year and next year, but over the next several decades, is making sure that we have an appropriate educated workforce that can meet employers' demands.
So, Phil, the educated workforce is clearly a really good thing that we as a state want to be investing in. It's also a long-term plan, though, right? It takes a while to educate our workforce. And we've been doing this for a long, long time. But as far as having employees to drive further growth, you know, in the past, people have been moving into the state because we have such a strong economy. Now that the United States, pretty much nationwide, there's clearly exceptions. There's states that aren't doing as well, but most states are hitting on all cylinders. People that want jobs in the states that they live in probably have good prospects. You know, how do we compete? How do we get the workers that we need to continue the growth that we've seen over the past decade?
Yeah, I mean, that's really one of the challenges is how do we do that in as we're competing out there in a national and international marketplace? How do we get workers here to fill our jobs? I think part of it is focusing on the areas where we have strengths and being able to draw in employees in there, as you see our growing tech sector and other things like that. So making sure, especially in certain areas where maybe we have a comparative advantage, being able to draw workers in there. Another aspect of it, and I know this is sometimes hard for employers, but we're not in a recession environment in terms of wages and being able to hire employees at any wage, that in order to get the best employees, you need to be paying good, competitive, solid wages. So it's, I agree that it is a challenge. It's not only short-term in this competitive environment, but long-term. And again, sometimes we think of it as us just competing against other states, but really in these things, we are competing worldwide as, you know, trying to be a home that's attractive. And the other piece of that that the governor has really emphasized is one of the things that attracts people to the state is quality of life. And as we grow, that's, you know, growth is our major challenge in the state of Utah. How do we manage that growth in a way that doesn't diminish the quality of life that is so attractive to many people?
One of the alternatives to attracting talent from out of state, of course, is to grow our own, who already know about our great quality of life. What, if any, initiatives is the state looking at in terms of enhancing technical education in order to be able to educate our own workforce to be able to take on these new jobs?
Yeah, and that's been a focus, certainly in the budget. The governor has some strong recommendations related to technical education. In addition to that, he's trying to highlight the issue and has declared 2018 the year of technical education. He actually rolled out his budget at the Davis Technical College to try to highlight the many opportunities that are out there. Certainly, for many people in our workforce, it's a four-year degree, but for a lot of other people, maybe it's not. And there are actually a lot of high-wage jobs right now that are going unfilled that don't require a four degree, that require, you know, a two-year associate's degree or even a technical certificate. So I think it's a matter of all of those, making sure people are aware, starting in middle school and into high school, that students at that age, and certainly In the post-secondary realm, both in the university systems and the technical colleges, that people are aware of the opportunities that are out there. And again, many good high-wage opportunities that are available.
You know, at your summit, not everybody was as optimistic. There was a quote by Natalie Gauchnow, who is the associate dean at the David Eccles School of Business. And she says that Utah reached its peak 2 years ago, and our employment growth, our business growth has been slowing since. First, do you agree with that comment? And was there a discussion on what we need to do in order to get back on the curve that we were on, the growth curve we were on previously?
Yeah, and I think it is accurate that we were up. If you look at our year-over-year job growth rate, 2 years ago we were in the range of 4%, kind of between 3.5% and 4%. Now we're closer to our long-term average. You know, if you look back over a 50-year or something like that average, where we're closer to 3, which is where we've been over the last couple years, last year and this year. And I expect we'll continue to be in that range. I suppose part of it is a question of, do we think that's good growth or is that slowing growth? It will be interesting to me to see what happens with these tax cuts. Because I have seen, certainly we have the labor supply issue that we have to deal with, but I have seen kind of some business enthusiasm out there where it seems like there's been hesitancy to make many significant commitments. This has provided opportunities there. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think certainly there's still question as to the impacts of that. But that's, I think, one of the remaining questions. What, now that businesses, especially with the cut in the corporate tax rate, repatriation of some of these foreign profits, what are businesses going to do with that?
Are we seeing any evidence of new spur in capital investment and, you know, new plant, new equipment as a result of the tax cut here in Utah yet?
I think it's probably too early to tell.
Yeah.
With, you know, some of that just kind of barely hitting with the repatriation of foreign profits. That'll kind of take place over time some. So I think it's probably too early to tell what will happen. But I think it does create a lot of opportunity for that. If that's something that obviously businesses need to feel, if they're going to make that investment, that on the other side they're going to be seeing the return from that.
Yeah, no, the impact of the tax cuts is going to be interesting to see. The timing is interesting to me of this tax cut. Typically, moves like this are done when the economy is slowing and we want to jumpstart. At least in recent history, this is the first time I've seen this much stimulus being put into the economy at a time of full employment. And hopefully it will result in taking us to the next level. It's interesting when there are these shortages, specifically workers and labor. And of course, the last 20 years, we've seen really lukewarm growth in wages for workers. And my hope is through this that we'll start to see some wage growth increase for the workers. Might not necessarily be a good thing for the economy, though, as the wage growth continues. And you might have the stimulus fighting the wage growth, the increased cost of business. I want to move to another point, another major tenet of the summit. Actually, the woman that brought it up, Juliet Tennert, who's the chief economist for the Kern Gardner Public Policy Institute, she brought up another headwind potentially for the state is just the environment, the air quality. Talk to us about that discussion.
Yeah, I do agree that that's a challenge for us, both from on a real basis and on a perception basis. So, you know, if you look at where we've come, we've actually had very significant reductions in air pollutants that are emitted over time. That being said, there's still a lot of work left to do to deal with those. So it's a challenge there. And then back to this quality of life issue, that's part of the ability to retain and to attract companies here is having that perception, right, of hey, this is a place I want to be as for my company, place I want my employees to be, and it's moving to Tier 3 fuels, which we're right on the verge of over the next 2 or 3 years, will be significant. Tier 3 standards in cars. So all of that will have a very significant effect. That being said, like our topography is what it is, and it's something I think we're going to continue, even with reduced levels of emissions that we're going to have to continue to target in terms of continuing to make improvements and letting people know about those improvements. Because we likely will still have days, even with significantly reduced emissions, that we'll continue to see that have those inversion days occasionally.
Other states have taken initiatives that go beyond federal requirements with respect to air impacts of fuel consumption. Is the state considering any of its own special regulations in order to deal with the inversion issue that we see repeated in the Valley?
Yeah, so it's a lot of times people aren't aware of this, but we actually have enacted a lot of different regulations. I'm trying to see if I can find the number really quickly, but I want to say somewhere around 30 different regulations to improve air quality. That being said, a lot of times we kind of think of the air quality issue as somebody else's problem, right? So somebody else needs to do this or that. It really is a problem for all of us, that each of us individually in our lives and the decisions that we make in terms of driving, in terms of energy efficiency, kind of all these things add up, all these little decisions that we make individually add up to significant impacts overall in terms of air quality.
And I think that segues into another issue that I think we'd like to talk about, which is estate tax reform issues. I noticed at the summit there was some discussion of that, and of course one possibility that I think was raised was the fact that there's a gas tax collection shortfall. You know, as an old economics student, one of the things that would strike me is that if you increase the gas tax, people might use less gas. So might that be some way to, you know, go after a couple of problems at once?
Yes, absolutely. And the governor has proposed better aligning the way we pay for transportation with use of transportation. Whether that's gas tax, vehicle miles traveled, congestion-based pricing, all these sorts of things where you have better alignment between use of the resource and paying for the resource. The other piece of that the governor's proposed that it seems like is getting support in the legislature is allowing use of state funds for transit, which hasn't been done in the past. So typically, that's been handled locally in the state. Involvement from a fiscal standpoint is for roads, and now kind of reprioritizing state funding to say what gives us the best bang for the buck in terms of transportation, whether it's transit or roads or even something else.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Phil Dean. He works at the state budget director. I'm sorry, he is the state budget director in chief economist for the governor's office of planning and budget. Phil, we're just talking about taxes. The gas tax, as Roger pointed out, only pays for about half of what it costs to keep our roads maintained. There was also talk about adding under the umbrella of what gets taxed in the state of Utah for purchases. Currently, goods are taxed, but services are not. What kind of impact would that have on the state if we started taxing services?
Yeah, and that's something that we are and will continue to look at. And we do tax some services, actually. You look at dry cleaning services or hotel services or car repair services. So we do have some services that we tax, but we also have a very broad set of services that we don't tax. And that's part of the discussion I think we need to have, as we currently don't have a sales tax in particular that is aligned to the current economy, that going forward, you could reduce the rate very significantly if you broadened what is taxed. That has beneficial economic effects of minimizing the ways that the tax system changes economic behavior. I've seen some estimates that, you know, we have a statewide average of about 6.5, 6.75, somewhere in there between the state and local sales tax rates, that maybe you could get down into the threes or fours in terms of a sales tax rate if you broadened that sales tax base. So that's a discussion that has been going on, and we hope will continue to take place. It certainly, there's no easy answers in any of this, but hopefully that's something that we can continue to explore if we want our sales tax to long-term be a sustainable revenue source for the state and for local government.
One of the things that was also noted was the notion that a corporate income tax change was potentially on the agenda for this term. What's the thinking there, and do you have any on how that would work?
Yeah, so in terms of the corporate income tax, the discussion, main discussions that I've heard relate to how for corporations that do business in multiple states, how that income is apportioned between the states. And the way historically it was done was equally weighting your property in a state compared to your total property, your sales in the state compared to your total sales, your payroll in a state compared to your total payroll, and equally weighting those. In recent years, I'd say over maybe the last 10 or 15 years, many states have been moving more toward emphasizing what's called the sales factor, the sales component of those three. So that's the discussion that I've heard in terms of corporate tax changes, you know, putting aside the federal whatever happened there, but with state corporate tax changes is adjusting that apportionment formula.
One issue that I think is particularly of concern in this area is whether or not there are going to be changes in lodging or hotel taxes that would particularly affect a resort area like this. What's the status of that?
Yeah, so my understanding that there's a proposal out there. I have heard, I'm not sure exactly where the bill's at in the process. I have heard resistance to that. So I think that one may still be up in the air in terms of what happens with that.
My understanding is that it was a substantial increase, and I suspect you might be hearing a lot of resistance from the several square miles that surround us here in Park City.
I'm guessing that's probably likely.
Hey Phil, take us behind the scenes, if you will. You're the state budget director. You're the chief economist for the governor's Office of Planning and Budget. I would assume when somebody comes up with, hey, you know, a new tax plan, we should tax more services, we should consider taxing other entities at a higher level. You're the one that's actually running the numbers and saying this is how it's going to impact the state. Is that accurate? Is that you and your team that are doing the forecast?
Yeah, so we're involved in that. On a lot of these issues, we work together with the State Tax Commission. A lot of times they have much of the underlying data that you need to do an analysis like that. So typically it's our office, the Legislative Fiscal Analyst Office is involved in that, and the Tax Commission.
So take us behind the scenes, because we just had the federal government enact a major tax cut, and we had forecasts, you know, it's going to raise the deficit by X dollars, and then other people were saying, no, it's actually going to pay down the deficit. What kind of pressures does your office have when you're trying to do these forecasts, and how do you do that? How do you do the
forecast? Yeah, so that's one of the real challenges that we have had. We worked together to come up with a consensus forecast of the impact of the federal tax changes on state revenues, because our state individual income tax and corporate tax are tied directly to definitions in the federal tax code. So as you change tax codes on the federal side, that has impacts here. Our estimates were that the state might get $25 to $80 million. More with federal tax changes that for the most part cut revenues on the federal side, but potentially increase revenues a little bit here on the state side. So we work with the Tax Commission. They have, especially on income tax, they have much of the underlying data to kind of, you run an analysis under current law and run an analysis under the changes with different things with sales tax. You'll look at economic census data to say, you know, different sectors of the economy, how big are they? What's the dollar amount? If we apply the state tax rate against that, what's the amount of revenue that would occur there? And then for existing things currently subject to sales tax, that you have the taxable sales data from companies filing returns that we don't see individually, but we see in aggregate.
Okay, and Phil,
Ag Commission sees in detail.
Great. Phil, unfortunately, we need to wrap it up there. Our guest has been Phil Dean. He's the State Budget Director and Chief Economist for the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget. Phil, it was a great conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And stay tuned to Mound Money on KPCW. Up next, we will be talking to the folks out at Outer Isle Gourmet. They make a plant-based version of one of our favorite foods, pizza. So stay tuned, please.
Hi, this is Kevin Holliday, bike buyer for Jan's, supporting KPCW. Jan's Bike Shop is open year-round for sales and service. We offer bikes from Trek, Scott, and Santa Cruz. Bike apparel from Gore, Bontrager, and Club Rod. Available at our flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mound Money. Up next is Jean David with Outer Isle Gourmet. We are currently working to get that guest on the line. It appears they are on the line now.
Good morning, Jean.
Good morning.
And thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jean, tell us a little bit about Outer Isle Gourmet and how you came to be in this business.
Well, it really was born out of our own health journey. My husband and I kind of made a shift in our diet probably 7 years ago and took the empty carbs and processed carbs out of our diet. And really kind of at that time, paleo was not around yet. So it was basically a paleo diet, just protein, fruits and vegetables. But we really missed that vehicle to put things on, you know, because we took bread out of our diet. So we missed having turkey and avocado on something or whatever it was. So, at that point, the cauliflower pizza crust was kind of out there on Pinterest and being seen. And so I really began working on a formula that we could commercialize. That was my initial thought. If we could get this, it would be a great product for the market.
So did it start out in your own test kitchen at home? Is that basically you started experimenting with your own recipes?
Yes, and we wore the door off of our oven, and the heating element burned out as well. So, yes, we started it in our home and test marketed it with them. I had an R&D group is what I called them, and we deliver product to them once a week. We had cauliflower rice and zucchini noodles and another squashatoni is what I'd call it. Product line as well, a raw product line that was just the vegetables in substitutes for the pastas that we started with as well. So, we delivered to that group for 6 to 8 months before, you know, while we really worked on packaging and all of those things just to get some customer feedback.
So, Jean, I think a lot of people have played with different recipes in their kitchen and thought, hey, this could be a business. Very, very few actually end up making it a business. How did you successfully navigate that transition?
I will say from the beginning, that was our target, was that we are going to do, if we do this, it's going to be a nationally distributed product line. So that was our target from the beginning. And the persistence in that vision early on was what kind of continued to drive us. It was not easy because it's not easy to get pricing for your cost of goods and projections and all of that when you're a startup, because nobody really wants to talk to you. A supplier doesn't care about who you are. You know, they don't want to spend the time with you, really, to give you the numbers you need to have accurate projections, because at that point we were still buying our ingredients retail from Trader Joe's.
That's funny.
Had
you started a food business before? Had you been an entrepreneur before? What was your background going into this?
Yes, I would say I'm definitely entrepreneur in my blood. I'm 12th out of 13 children, my, you know, I had my first business when I was in fifth grade. Summer after fifth grade, I had a summer camp at my house and was very successful. I, you know, did 9 to 12, 3 days a week. People dropped their kids off at my house, and I had a summer camp at my house, you know. So I would say early on, it's always been something that I just did very naturally. I did bring a product line to market. I had four kids, so was always doing businesses, stay-at-home mom with businesses that allowed me to be with them, one of which brought a line of gourmet cookie dough to the grocery store shelf, which was no preservatives, all natural, just real cookie dough in resealable tubs. So, yes, I had had that experience once.
And I should disclose that I indeed have a small investment in Outer Isle Gourmet. Jean, tell us a little bit about how about the product itself. What is your market that you're aiming for, and what kind of ingredients are you using to appeal to that market?
So our ingredients are the key to our product. Our ingredients are cauliflower, Parmesan cheese, egg, and sunflower lecithin. So very clean label. That's another thing we were really committed to. I've got a fitness background, was a personal trainer at one point. So from the beginning, we really wanted a healthy, clean label as well as good nutrition panel, something that we would eat ourselves and be proud of ourselves. And so, yeah, that's what's driven this product from the beginning and continues to be our differentiating factor.
That was what I wanted to ask you about. I know that increasingly I'm seeing other sort of cauliflower crusts and products coming onto the market. How are you different than what I would see in the competitors?
Yes, great question, because the market is, there are some really beginning to come out. And the difference is they're using filler flours. So while, yes, they do have cauliflower now in that gluten-free pizza crust, The thing is, they're also using gluten-free flours, which like rice flour and tapioca starch, which just increases the carbs and contributes carbs to what would normally be a cauliflower pizza crust. So a cauliflower pizza crust authentically does not have filler flours in it for the purposes of people that are migrating to cauliflower because it's replacing the carbs in their life.
Yeah,
that's the big difference.
Let's talk about the nutritional content. So Roger brought in a sample. It's probably 9 inch in diameter, the crust. It's a 5 ounce package. For myself, it's 2 servings in this package. But for myself, I would eat the whole thing if I was having a pizza, truth be told. And for that, the cauliflower crust would be bringing 240 calories, which isn't bad. Surprisingly to me, though, it would also give me 20 grams of protein, which is a lot of protein in 240 calories. I know cauliflower is very low in protein. How are you getting the protein in there?
Right. Well, let me clarify. The package you have has 2 pizza crusts in it. So let's go to one of our pizza crusts because that's really a serving. So it's 120 calories. Are you following me?
I am. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are 2 pizza crusts in here, which I missed. It's kind of vacuum packed.
Right. So just let's go with one, just because that's kind of what I'm familiar with. And the protein. So maybe does that make it better?
It's 100. The ratio is the same. It's 120 calories, but 10 grams of protein, which is a lot of protein for the calorie count. How are you getting the protein in the cauliflower crust?
Yes, it's Parmesan cheese and egg. So
it's almost as high of a protein count as I take a protein powder every day, which is not the greatest tasting thing in the world, but I do it just because it gives me the health benefits that I want. And I could be eating a pizza crust and getting very similar protein, which is awesome.
And with only 3 grams of saturated fat, as I'm looking on there.
Yeah, and is that a differentiator? You mentioned Trader Joe's. You were buying your retail products at Trader Joe's. You're currently in Whole Foods. I was at Trader Joe's this weekend, and there's several pizza crust cauliflower options out there, as Roger pointed out earlier. Is having that much protein, is that a point of parity with your competition, or does it separate you?
It separates us, but the big thing about the Trader Joe's cauliflower pizza crust is it's got corn flour in it, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think potato flour, possibly. So, again, they're using those filler flours, which jack up the carb content. So, in the whole purpose of the niche that we in the market that we're going after is people who are looking for low glycemic foods to replace the high glycemic load of the carbs that are in the other products. So I would never be eating a pizza crust. I would never eat that pizza crust just because of the carb count on it. But I'll eat, you know, the cauliflower, our cauliflower pizza crust that has no filler flours in it. I'll eat it several times a week now.
We've talked about the difficulty of bringing a product like this to market. Tell us a little bit about how you achieve a distribution network. I know you start in a small bakery and somewhere in the Santa Barbara area. How do you get a national distribution network?
Okay, so the way it begins is you got to deliver, usually direct delivery, and DSD is what they call that, direct store delivery. So we did start out that way. We were lucky enough to have our product scoped out by Whole Foods. The local forager found our product really before we were ready to hit the market and came to us and said, hey, let's work together. I'd like to bring this in. And so we did. And so we started off with four local Whole Foods stores that we had to deliver to ourselves for about a year. And the reason being is a distributor is usually not interested in picking up a product that doesn't have any distribution channels set up. They prefer to have, you know.
Which is kind of the irony, right? Because as an entrepreneur, that's what you're hiring them for, but they don't want to take you on as a client. You know, it's just a brutally.
There's lots of irony.
Yeah, it's just a brutally competitive business. You know, if Roger had come to me and said, hey, Doug, I'm thinking of investing in a food product, and I don't care what the food product is, you know, and I hope this is wildly successful for you and for Roger, but I would have really suggested he use a lot of caution just because it's such a very, very tough business. Grocery is a low-margin business. Most food entrepreneurs are using distributors, as you mentioned. And the distributors take their cut, and boy, there's just very little left for the company to reinvest in growth. And, you know, I think Whole Foods has really been a blessing to the country and specifically for food entrepreneurs, and I hope the Amazon purchase does not change that. But there are many, many food labels that were launched because Whole Foods will give food entrepreneurs a chance. So you started with four stores. How many Whole Foods are you in now?
We're in over 160 now, and that pretty much happened within the last year. So we were in four for quite some time. We got our market data. We got sell-through, which is what they want to see. We proved our concept because we were first to market. No, I mean, really, when we came out with cauliflower pizza crust and cauliflower sandwich buns, we were kind of like a three-eyed monster, like, what? Bread made with cauliflower? You know? So now, of course, everybody's on board. Everybody thinks it's great. Oh, yeah, of course, that makes total sense. So we really had to prove our concept. We had to do some innovative packaging because cauliflower is 80% water, so couldn't put it in a Ziploc and zip it up and do those things. We had to work with a scientist to really formulate our packaging and get that down. It's been a great learning and also growing. It's been a great experience, but you have to be committed and tenacious to overcome the obstacles early on.
And the product is available here at the local Park City Whole Foods. Other than Whole Foods, where else are you being distributed now?
We're in lots of independent natural food stores. So in Park City, because I'm not familiar with that particular area. I don't know that we have any other ones in Park City per se, but Whole Foods is there. We're in Lucky's Markets, which are out of Colorado. We're in Natural Grocers, Vitamin Cottage. You've got those in that area too, the natural grocery stores. So yeah, we're in several different other chains that are regional based.
Okay, and we have time for one last question. You're a food entrepreneur. The learning curve is steep. There are folks in our audience that are possibly want to be food entrepreneurs, having gone through the journey of developing the recipe, finding a packer, starting off at 4 Whole Foods, now in over 100 Whole Foods. What advice would you give to somebody that's thinking of, I want to launch a food product and get it in Whole Foods and try to take it nationwide?
I would say surround yourself with a great team, people who can help you along the way. It's really key to get critical information from people who have done it before, who have gone before. The markups and the margins that are in there that you need to know going, you know, starting out. Like, I knew that we would have a distribution markup and a broker markup. So, you know, a lot of people who come out with a product just look at what they need to get on their retail. They start selling direct and get that money retail. And then they go to commercialize it and get it into a store and go, oh my gosh, you know, your profit's going to be, you know, you've got to cut that margin by half because it's going to the store. And then you throw in a distributor, you know, and a broker. So early on, we knew that those markups were in there, and we prepared for those. We prepared for the long haul. We had investors that joined us for the journey, and I highly recommend that just because of you need that support financially. It's too stressful as an entrepreneur to not have that support, and it makes the company. It allows you to do what you need to do early on.
Thanks, John. We've been talking with Jean David of Outer Isle Gourmet. We'll be back to Mountain Money after this break.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to Mound Money. Interesting conversation with Jean David of Outer Isle Gourmet, cauliflower pizza crust. In studio with us now, we have Colleen McGinn. Colleen has created an interesting business for those of you that are trivia fans. Colleen's business is trivia. Colleen, welcome to Mound Money.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So tell us about your business.
So I do a local trivia night in town called Megamind Pub Quiz, and we're currently at 4 locations, Flanagan's on Tuesday nights, Park City Brewery on Wednesday, and then on Thursday we do an après trivia up at Park City Mountain. The fourth one is up at the Chateau, but there's a private one.
And how did you get into this business, Colleen?
Well, I'm originally from D.C., as you know, Roger, and in the D.C. area, there are trivia nights, honestly, on every corner. And so you have the pick of the litter of where you want to go. And when I moved out here in 2009, I just realized that there was a public need for trivia. We didn't have one on Main Street, and so I decided to start my own.
And Roger shared with me that he's going to an upcoming trivia event here. I suspect, having been friends with Roger for a long time, that he's quite good at trivia.
Yes, Roger and his family are very good. Watch out for his team. This is kind of a role reversal with him asking the questions. Normally, I ask the questions to him. But yes, he's a big supporter of Megamind Pub Quiz.
Okay, and so it's fun for him. He kind of explained the model to me where people each pitch in a little bit of money, and that's the prize money for the winner. Mm-hmm. But how do you, as a business, what's your revenue model? How do you make money?
Well, the different bars, they pay me to come in and have this trivia night and to bring people to their establishment. So, you know, there's the different businesses that I work for. But then I also work for DSC, which is a company management group. So whenever there's different companies that come in, they'll hire me to entertain their group. It's kind of a team building type of event.
Tell us about some of the special events like that that you've done that our listeners would find interesting.
Well, we've had a lot of really exciting ones. Within the last year, we did one for the Utah Jazz, which was so much fun. They had a game night, so they had the different players go to different events. Mine was the Mega Mind Pub Quiz, of course. And so I had Donovan Mitchell, who is potentially Rookie of the Year this year, and his family come and play. We also had Ricky Rubio as well, which was it's just fun. It's kind of a surreal experience to give trivia to those guys, particularly to give basketball trivia. But we've also done it for eBay, for their team, as well as State Farm and the Salt Lake City Bees. That was a really fun one as well. So it's kind of just been expanding. People have been finding out about trivia and how they can use it for their business model and for their employees as well, and bringing them together.
What about just for a private family? You know, they're having a party. They want to do some fun for the party. There's going to be 30 or 40 guests. Is it something that's reasonable for an individual to do?
Absolutely. We've had a couple events like that as well. We did one for a baby shower, and we did it specifically baby themed, which, you know, that was a hit. And then we also got hired to do a birthday party as well. So I think it's just kind of, you know, going outside of the box of the normal things that you could do for these type of events. And trivia has kind of caught on in the last couple of years. It's, you know, it's quirky, it's fun. And it gets everyone working together. You know, I mean, the main goal is that everyone has fun and that they leave with a smile on their face. And I feel like that's what we're doing. You know, particularly for Park City, there's so many people coming to this town, you know, lots of visitors, and it's giving them and their family something to do. You know, we have the skiing, of course, during the day, but at night, if you come to Main Street, you know, you got dinner, you can go get dinner and check out, I guess, for this is family-wise, you know, check out some of like the museum and stuff. But for kids, you know, it's fun to have something for them to do.
So give us an idea. What should a family budget if they said, hey, this sounds like fun, we should do that? What does something like this cost to host?
For someone just to attend or?
No. For somebody to say a birthday party or something like that.
I mean, it depends. It all depends on what type of event it is, how many people there are. You know, we have a weekly rate for the different businesses who hire me every week. You know, they get a discounted rate because I'm there the entire winter. But for those, you know, that come in for just one event, I'm able to price it a little bit differently, you know, because it is a good product. And I feel like they're getting a lot out of it, too.
Now, a typical event at a Flanagan's or a Park City Brew Pub runs almost 2 hours. Hour and a half?
Hour and a half.
Okay. And how long does it take you? Sort of like a teacher in her lesson plans. How long does it take you to prepare for a 90-minute session?
It takes me about, for each one, it takes me about 2 hours. That's just to get all, I've kind of have it as a well-oiled machine now of I know what I want to look for. People give me ideas of what they like to see. So I kind of search via the topic. But it's fun for me, you know, I enjoy doing it. But one of the tricky things, is that I need to make sure I word it appropriately because otherwise they, as Roger knows, people will come at you with different, you have to have one specific answer. So that, you know, wording the questions, want to make sure that that's right. But yeah, I mean, it's a very delicate process and I want to make sure that it's fun for everyone. So when I look up the different trivia topics, I make sure that it covers a wide range so everyone can enjoy it.
So we've only got a minute left, but tell our listeners, A, if they want to contact you directly, how would they do that? And what are some of your upcoming events?
So if they want to contact Mega Mind Pub Quiz, we are on Facebook. So if you go to the Facebook, www.facebook.com/megamind.pubquiz, you can message us there. Or you could email us at megamind.pubquiz@gmail.com. And so the upcoming events, we quiz for a cause. Two of every $5 goes to the overall winner's charity of choice. And it's a 6-week tournament. So on Tuesday and Wednesday, it's the 6 week for both our Flanagan's and Park City Brewery locations. So we'll be finding out which charity we'll be donating to. Which I know KPCW, they recently got one. They're one of the charities.
Now, at the Flanagan's location, kids under 21 can attend?
They can.
Okay, but not at the park, not at the brewery.
Park City Brewery, no. It all depends on the licensing.
Right.
In the summertime, we'll be back at Versante, which is a great spot because you can bring your family, and the food's amazing there, and you have great views of the mountain, so that'll be fun when we're back there.
Okay, Colleen McGinn of, tell me your company name.
Megamind Pub Quiz.
Megamind Pub Quiz. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be back to wrap up the show in just a minute.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We want to start off by thanking our great guests this morning. They include Phil Dean, who is the State Budget Director and Chief Economist from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. Also, John David from Outer Isle Gourmet and Colleen McGinn. It was a great show. Enjoyed the conversation, and thanks to all three of those guests for coming in.
We also want to thank our sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Verdian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
You know, Roger, with Colleen, I was going to have her ask, I'm sure she has a couple trivia questions up her sleeve that she could have asked. Given your trivia background, I'm quite sure unless the theme was aviation or surfing, I would have lost to you. So what do you like about trivia?
Well, what it does, the first thing that happens at these sessions is they make you put your phone away. So for the evening, you're in an environment. One of the things that's happened is in my youth, there was this concept of bar bets where you would argue with people and no one could pull out their phone and resolve it. Nowadays, instantaneously, a conversation turns to, let me get the answer. And one of the nice things about this environment is you get a question, you're not sure what the answer is, and you argue and discuss with your teammates live and try to figure out how to back into it sometimes. And that's really a nice different way to spend an evening.
Yeah, you know, particularly here in Park City, as you said, there's a lot of fun things to do here. But that's something that's outside of the box. And trivia is just a fun way to spend some time with your friends. It's also, I'm always impressed at the knowledge that some people have that you had no idea they had an expertise in an area.
One of the things you learn is the generational differences. Like sometimes you'll do a music round and there'll be an entire decade where I have no idea what the musicians are. So I'm always grateful if I have one of my children with me to help me bail me out in those circumstances.
Yeah, and Roger, today was a show where you helped line up the second two guests. It was Jean David with the pizza crust. What was it about that business that you saw that you liked and said, I want to invest in them?
Well, again, as I've told you, I think I've known Jean a long time. And it was when she came out with a concept and explained the detail with which she had analyzed product, recipe, distribution, marketing. And you and I have seen a lot of food pitches in our time. I thought this one was one worth taking a small bet on.
Excellent. Well, hopefully it pays off. I got to tell you, I was really impressed. I was at a party and was eating pizza, and there were several pizzas there, and I was just enjoying one. And the one that was actually my favorite was your friend's cauliflower pizza, of all things. So good. That hopefully is a good prelude of things to come. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. NPR News is next.